Pop Curse, Episode 0. I'm Ryan J. Downey. At various points in my life, I've fallen in love with music, movies, television, journalism, and comedy. I feel very blessed, and not in the hashtag blessed way, to have been able to create a career that involves all of it. I'm a longtime reporter, writer, and producer who's contributed to MTV News, MSNBC, IFC, VH1, and Yahoo. I've written, produced, and hosted projects for Marvel Comics, Disney, Maker Studios, Hearst Media, Machinima, and Crypt TV. I've covered film, music, television, and politics for Billboard, The Hollywood Reporter, Huffington Post, The San Francisco Chronicle, OC Weekly, All Music Guide, Decibel, and many other publications. I've also written more than a dozen cover stories, including in-depth features on Green Day, Fall Out Boy, Pierce the Veil, Black Veil Brides, Falling in Reverse, Sleeping with Sirens, and AFI. I've written biographical material for several artists, including Slipknot, Megadeth, Dream Theater, The Used, Skrillex. I'm the founder of Superhero Artist Management. We represent bands and producers primarily from the worlds of rock, metal, punk, and indie. Superhero artists past and present have appeared at Coachella, Stagecoach, Austin City Limits, Warped Tour, Reading and Leeds, Download, and on international tours with genre-defining acts like Nine Inch Nails, Morrissey, and Slayer. The producers we represent have worked with everyone from Rob Zombie to Slipknot, The Cure, Queensryche, Hatebreed, Glassjaw, Every Time I Die, and many, many more. I'm an avid fan of creation itself, music, TV, film, hand-to-hand combat, weapons training, radical theology, and most of all, my friends, my family, my kids. So what is Pop Curse? Well, it's going to be many things. It's an intersection between movies, music, television, and pop culture. Pop culture has been a blessing and a curse in my life, and frankly, if we're being honest, a blessing and a curse upon the world. Like many of my friends, contemporaries, and heroes, I believe the creative arts are an important facet of human civilization, and with perhaps a bit of understatement, one of the best things about being alive. Now more than ever, given the world's climate, both literally and figuratively, we need our storytellers, our greater creators, our cultural saboteurs, professional rabble-rousers, lifetime malcontents, and unifying performers. If there's any kind of mission statement for Pop Curse, it can be summed up like this. Authenticity and POV. Those are the two things I connect with in movies and music and literature and my friends and in my life. Tell the truth. Speak your mind. Expose your soul. It doesn't have to be my point of view. It doesn't have to be political, religious, or clearly defined by ideology or experience. You just have to have something to say, something to communicate, a way to contribute to the cultural conversation. I want to see people living, breathing, and bleeding for their art. That's what matters. I can draw equal inspiration from Dark Throne and KRS-One, from Stanley Kubrick and Anne Rice, because these are people who mean it. There's a purity of intention. I don't always have to love the execution, but if I can feel the uncompromising dedication to your art, the urgent need to express yourself, to provoke, to inspire, I'm on board. I will stand behind you. I will stand with you. As one of my favorite characters from recent pop culture once said, only boring people are bored. I love you, Betty Draper. I love podcasts. I think I started listening to them around 2009, 2010. Like a lot of people, my entry point was WTF with Marc Maron. I connected to his naked honesty about himself, his self-examination. I really appreciated most of all, though, his conversations, the interviews, the intimacy, the honesty, the truth that he can get to. I actually had an opportunity to visit his house with my friend Jay Baker, who was a guest on his podcast a few years ago. I don't think Maron really liked having me in his kitchen waiting for Jay. Probably had something to do with the fact that I made Jay really late getting him there, which is a story for another time. I digress. The next podcast that I really fell in love with is called Linoleum Knife. It's hosted by two of my favorite people, Alonzo Duralde and Dave White, two film critics here in Los Angeles, who I can't say enough good things about. I've had the great pleasure of guest hosting On the Lamb Knife once back in like 2012, and I appeared as a guest just a couple of months ago talking about Star Wars Rogue One. It's a film podcast, if I didn't say that before. So here I am in the podcast world. I mean, podcasts are where I've heard James Hetfield talk about his love of beekeeping in depth. It's where I spend a lot of my time, especially when I'm in the car, which, as someone who lives in Southern California, is often. For now, Pop Curse is a podcast. But stay tuned for what comes next. I'm going to have guests, and lots of them. Co-hosts, too. But I wanted to launch this episode zero all by myself. I'm even editing it. It's DIY. You can blame my roots in the punk and hardcore scene. After all, I was putting out zines with my buddy Matt Reese as a sophomore in high school. Doing fanzines led to my first professional writing job, which is also a story for another time. Why episode zero? Blame comic books. I just think the episode zeros are cool. And I'm not entirely sure when we're going to put out episode one. Once we do, these will be hitting with regularity, believe me. But for now, I think they call this a soft launch, so just bear with me. And shout out to one of my closest friends and favorite people in the world, Ryan Clark, who designed the Pop Curse imagery that's likely glowing from your iPhone or dashboard as you listen to this right now. So, without any further long-winded crap about myself, which I promise not to do every episode, it's episode zero. Let's start the show.
Let's see. I think the first thing we got to do is, obviously, like you guys were expecting, is we got to thank Jethro Tull for not putting out an album this year, right? And also, obviously, we got to thank the Academy for giving Jethro Tull the award in 1989. Read between the lines, know what I mean? So I want to thank the... Oh, you guys figured it out, huh?
That, of course, was Lars Ulrich from my favorite band of all time, Metallica. He was accepting the Best Metal Performance Grammy for Metallica's Black Album in 1992. That record, of course, is the largest selling album of the SoundScan era. That means since they started counting records with Nielsen SoundScan in, what, the early 90s, I believe. That record has been the biggest one since then. Something like 16 point something or other million copies in the U.S. alone since it was released. That's the black record with the snake on it. You know, Sad But True, Inner Sandman, Of Wolf and Man, Through the Never. An amazing record. Possibly a dividing line for some fans, but as I always say about Metallica, and I often talk about Metallica, people were calling them sellouts because Ride the Lightning had a ballad on it. So everybody just relax. And that's a conversation for another time, too. Believe me, I have plenty of Metallica things to talk about. But what I want to talk about right now are the Grammys. I got to attend the Grammys last night as I'm recording this. I've been to the Grammys a few times in the press area, either working as an interviewer on the red carpet or covering a number of the parties that happen both before or after the Grammys, the week leading up to the Grammys. They used to have something called the Special Merit Awards, which I covered a number of times for Billboard, which was pretty cool, sort of off-campus, off-site event that they would have at a really cool theater here in Los Angeles. But this was the first year that I had a ticket and a seat. And it was a really good seat, too. It was right behind front of house, right sort of towards the bottom of where the seats in the Staples Center, almost where the floor starts. I was there with a good friend of mine and colleague, Josh Bernstein, from Town Square Media. Josh is one of the people responsible for the Revolver Golden Gods Awards, the Rock and Roll Roast, the Alternative Press Music Awards. More importantly, he's a very, very good friend of mine. And was gracious enough to have me as his guest. We were both invited by some friends of ours who work for the Recording Academy. And I want to put that out there that there are some really great people at the Recording Academy. And I'm saying that, of course, because I'm about to get into this Metallica debacle from the other night. But honestly, I have great relationships there with a handful of people who I know to be awesome humans, who have the best intentions, who work very hard and execute things the right way, diligently. Like I said, I've been covering the Grammys for a long time as a reporter. I've met and interviewed, you know, from the president of the Recording Academy on down. Plenty of great people, smart people there. The Grammy Museum in particular in downtown Los Angeles, if you're ever here visiting or if you live here, definitely check that place out. There was a really awesome Ramones exhibit there recently. It's killer. They have great events and a little theater in there. I've seen documentaries there, a bunch of Q&As. I just went to this thing that was the celebration of the 50th anniversary of Sire Records. Sire Records, you know, one-time home to The Cult, Depeche Mode, The Smiths, Morrissey, so many artists that have been important to me and important to the world. I got to see the founder of Sire Records speak, along with Billy Duffy from The Cult, Brett Ratner, oddly enough, who was once a budding hip-hop manager and had a hip-hop group signed to Sire Records. Really interesting and bizarre. He was actually really great to listen to, telling some great stories from back in the day. Anyway, the Grammy Museum, check it out if you're ever in town. It's awesome, and the people who work there are really awesome. So, getting into the Grammys and Lars's joke from that 1992 win, which was actually their third win in the Best Metal Performance category. The metal category at the Grammys first started in the late 80s, and Metallica, who were riding high on And Justice for All at that time, you know, a lot of firsts for the band. Their first music video, after rather famously saying they would never make a music video, they of course made a music video for One. Their big national TV debut, they actually performed at the Grammys. And the first time there was a metal Grammy given, rather than going to Metallica, the surefire choice of, you know, bookies and gamblers everywhere, the Grammy went to Jethro Tull. No disrespect to Jethro Tull, but Jethro Tull is not metal. And like, you know, you can't please everybody. And like a lot of decisions at the Grammys over the years, right up to the other night, Adele beating out Beyonce, which upset quite a lot of people. You can't please everybody. But this, you know, Metallica being robbed of that first metal Grammy by the likes of Jethro Tull symbolizes to a lot of people what was wrong with the Recording Academy and its handling of heavy music, of metal, hardcore punk. You know, I mentioned that Ramones exhibit. The Ramones kind of famously never won a Grammy. They did, I think, get some sort of posthumous kind of lifetime achievement thing. And of course, like I said, there are great, smart, wonderful people working there now who put on a whole exhibit about the Ramones. We can shake our fists at some of these institutions, but it's oftentimes at the expense of forgetting really great people who end up working there. I mean, I remember once upon a time I was interviewing Glenn Danzig for MTV News, and he had a very unfavorable opinion of MTV. Of course, the MTV didn't care about the Misfits in the late 70s and early 80s. And I had to say to him at a certain point, like, dude, I was in elementary school when the Misfits broke up. You know, I wasn't here at MTV making those decisions. I'm here now. You know, I've infiltrated, and I'm interviewing Glenn Danzig because you're one of my favorite artists of all time. So let's deal in the now. You know, it's there's humans and behind these institutions and inside these institutions. You know, there have been people who've been working really hard to make a number of improvements about the way metal was treated at the Grammys. And certainly, leaps and bounds. I mean, huge strides have been made. The fact that a band like Gojira, a band like Mastodon, a band like Periphery can get nominated in the metal category is fantastic. Metallica is not only the biggest metal band of all time. They're one of the biggest bands of all time, period. And certainly the Grammys have made that initial egregious error up to them. I mean, they've won 8 Grammys since then. 9 if you include the Grammy they won in 2009 for the packaging design of Death Magnetic. Interestingly, by the way, a couple of those Grammys were for cover songs. Their cover of Queen, Stone Cold Crazy, won them a Grammy in 1991. Whiskey in the Jar, the Irish drinking song, popularized in that iteration by Thin Lizzy. They won a Grammy for that in 2000. You know, so they've got a small army and a small arsenal of Grammy trophies since then. And yet here we are in 2017. We get this moment, you know, like it or not, Metallica and Lady Gaga. Personally, I was optimistic and enthusiastic about it. I'm a fan of hers. I thought she was awesome at the Super Bowl, and I don't care about sports. It's the only part of, at least not those sports, it was the only part of the Super Bowl I even watched was her performance. I was excited about this. And not only was Metallica's name left out of the introduction, Hetfield's mic wasn't on. Now, I watched the broadcast version of this shortly before sitting down to do the podcast, and it actually didn't come off as bad watching it on TV as it did in the room. I mean, in the room, it was painful. You know, it was like whenever you're at a show and somebody gets up to do a guest vocal and the guest vocal mic isn't working, because it's never working, because the sound person in the venue never realizes that that's, you know, Jamie Josta from Hatebreed that's grabbing the mic with, you know, Killswitch Engage or whatever. They don't know what's happening. And by the time they figure it out, the guest appearance is usually over. It felt like that, but this was Metallica and it was at the Grammys. And when Lady Gaga started singing, her vocals were way too loud in the mix in the room. And then Hetfield goes to sing and literally his microphone isn't on at all. So then you think, well, whatever's happening, they're going to fix it, right? It doesn't really get fixed. Hetfield, who I've seen perform, you know, probably 100 times in my life, visibly upset and justifiably so. I mean, it just, whatever was happening, whoever fault it was, and it came out on TMZ today that it was likely a stagehand who worked for the Grammys who inadvertently unplugged something somewhere. What a travesty. My buddy Josh put it best. This must be people who really care about professional sports. This must be how they feel when their favorite team loses the big game. And that's how I felt. I was kind of depressed. Add to that, you know, I don't know whose idea it was to have those extras up on stage. They looked like they came from Central Casting or something. They were like models, impersonating metalheads, doing like faux metal dancing or something. I don't know who they were. Maybe they were relatives of somebody. Maybe they were legitimate metal fans. I don't know, but it looked ridiculous. And it reminded me of the MTV Icon Metallica special from several years back, which I actually worked on as part of the news department. I should say I covered it more than I worked on it. Oof. As you may or may not recall, that was Limp Bizkit and Avril Lavigne covering Metallica. It was a great idea, good intentions. They certainly are icons and are more deserving of anyone I can think of in the rock world for that honor. Really poor and awkward execution. I actually, at some point in the last year, found my old laminate from MTV Icon Metallica and posted it on Instagram. And Kirk Hammett actually left a comment underneath it that said, no comment. So, you know, for all of the fantastic, miraculous, wonderful, awesome things Metallica has done, you know, you can't win them all. An MTV Icon was one of those, eh. And then this Grammy performance, you know, the guys really still gave it their all. The song sounded awesome. When you could hear Hetfield, he was great. I thought Lady Gaga was great. But it just really, I think, sort of reopened that wound a little bit for metal. And it's like, no matter how hard we try, the metal community can't seem to catch a break from the mainstream. But, you know, maybe it isn't supposed to. Maybe that's part of what makes metal special and pure, is being the redheaded stepchild in some of those situations. And I will say, other than that, other than Hetfield's mic not working and those weird backup dancers, I had an awesome time at the Grammys. Adele was killer at the beginning of the show. That whole Beyonce production was definitely something to behold. I didn't know Bruno Mars played guitar, let alone would shred the solo in Let's Go Crazy. That was awesome. And my favorite, I should say my second favorite moment of the entire night was Adele's incredibly moving tribute to George Michael. I'm a huge George Michael fan. That was one celebrity death in the last year-ish that hit me pretty hard. You know, for me, that was, I'll be honest, that was a Lemmy level of sadness that I was overcome by. Huge fan of George Michael's on a number of levels. And I thought her reworking of Fast Love was really powerful. Of course, she very, you know, now very famously started over when she didn't think she was doing it justice, I thought was awesome. And, you know, like I talked about at the beginning of this podcast, and one of the things Pop Curse is going to be about, authenticity. And she showed it in spades, you know, from that moment all the way through, kind of rightly saying, hey, what does Beyonce have to do to win a Grammy for Album of the Year? You know, I've got enough Grammys. There's a whole other conversation again for another time. And I don't want to beat up on the Grammys because I, like I said, I had a great time. There are awesome people that work there. And hey, they invited Metallica to come and perform. That in and of itself is awesome. Which leads me to something else awesome that did happen. Granted, it was not part of the televised performance, but there was a metal Grammy given to a very deserving band, a band who actually was nominated for the song Hangar 18 in 1992 for Best Metal Performance, the year that the Black Album won, in that clip that I displayed before.
Wow. Fantastic. Only took 12 tries to get this. You know, last time we were here, we were talking to Kenny G, and he asked me how many times we were here, and he goes, well, 11 isn't that bad. And I said, how many times did it take you? And he said, 21. And I was like, oh my God, if it takes 21 times, I don't know that I'll live that long. Anyways.
That was Megadeth co-founder, vocalist, guitarist, primary songwriter, Dave Mustaine, accepting the band's first ever Grammy Award, which came after a previous 11 nominations. Huge congrats to Dave Mustaine, David Ellefson, Kiko, Dirk, everyone who's been part of the Megadeth family, past and present, including a formerly guitar player named Marty Friedman, who actually congratulated the entire band on Twitter. And Mr. Mustaine very graciously responded to him on Twitter. I also got to say a shout out to my seatmate, Josh Bernstein. Him and I think it was his joke, actually. I don't want to be a Carlos Mencia-style joke thief. Hello me, meet the Grammy. I tweeted that, and Dave Mustaine enjoyed that joke and commented so as such on Twitter. I got to say, for those who don't know, if you're listening to this and you know me, but you don't know this, I don't know how that's possible, but Megadeth was actually the band that got me into heavy metal. Going from new wave and punk rock and a lot of this sort of 80s dark wave romantic stuff that I was into, my friend Dave Rogers gave me a copy of Peace Sells But Who's Buying on cassette, and my life was changed by music yet again, not for the first time and not for the last time. But I fell immediately in love with the record, and I saw a magazine called Cream Presents Thrash Metal. It was a one-off special focusing on the then burgeoning thrash metal scene. Inside was an article called The 20 Greatest Thrash Metal Albums of All Time. It included records like Slayer's Reign in Blood, Metallica's Master of Puppets, I think there was a record from Creator, something from Celtic Frost. I think it might have been Into the Pandemonium, which also became one of my favorite albums of all time. That article was written by a guy named Don Kay, who I would meet many years later here in Los Angeles. Don is an awesome journalist. He covers primarily movies these days. I've gotten to meet him a handful of times. We're Facebook buddies. We share a lot of similar opinions on a lot of things. But that article was very informative for me as a young thrasher in discovering the whole family of bands that Megadeth had come from. And Don was very influential to me in terms of wanting to write about music and realizing that that was a thing that you could do, that you could write about metal bands and someone would publish it and kids would buy it and read it and live and die by it. So Megadeth, you won a Grammy. You know, it's one of those things where I like to think for a lot of these bands, it's not that they went towards the mainstream, it's that the mainstream came towards us. And it's exciting. It's a victory. It's a deserving band. There were a lot of deserving bands in that category. Gojira, of course. The guys from Korn, I didn't get to say hello to them, but I did see them a couple of times from a distance at the Grammys. And, you know, I do want to talk about, there's been some stuff going around online about how when the band went up to accept their Grammy, the house band at the Grammys played Master of Puppets. And of course, that's hilarious because Dave Mustaine used to be in Metallica, blah, 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 blah. The thing is, you know, maybe it was tone deaf on the part of the organizers there. I personally kind of feel like that's probably what they were going to play anyway. I think that was just sort of like a generic metal, you know, here's a metal, like it could have been Iron Man. It could have been Paranoid. It could have been, you know, just like, here's a metal riff everybody knows. Cause it was kind of, it was instrumental. It was like the riff to Master of Puppets. And then somebody just sort of wanking away guitar solo wise, not any kind of Master of Puppets actual guitar solo. And Mustaine clearly took the moment in stride. He's playing air guitar to it as he was walking up. He made a joke about it on Twitter when somebody brought it up the next day. I really don't think it was that big of a deal. When it was first told to me, because a part of the show wasn't televised and I didn't get to see it in person, when it was first described to me, I thought they played like the master recording of Master of Puppets over the PA, thinking it was a Megadeth song as they went up to accept their award. But it wasn't anything like that. And also, while we're clarifying things, people have talked about Hetfield kicking over the mic stand a couple of times, twice during the performance of Lady Gaga, and him throwing his guitar off stage, throwing it at a stagehand or at a tech or whatever. I just want to point out, I mean, yeah, there may have been a little extra oomph, a little extra frustration in that toss, but I'm pretty sure that he tosses his guitar like that at the end of just about every show, and that there's usually, there's someone waiting, probably his longtime tech or whatever, who knows that that's the moment to catch Papa Head's guitar. So I really don't think that was a big deal either. The last thing I want to say about the Metallica, as Lady Gaga called it, hashtag Metallica. The last thing I want to say about that is Laverne Cox, the wonderful actress from the wonderful show Netflix's Orange is the New Black. And I think she's on some new show on CBS now. She introduced Metallica and Lady Gaga and forgot to say Metallica. And if you go back and watch it, you know, she says something like 8-time Grammy Award winners and then however many Lady Gaga has. Lady Gaga, I think it was like a teleprompter thing where, I don't know, maybe she didn't know it was a duet, whatever it was. Laverne Cox apologized to Metallica and their fans on Twitter, which I thought was very classy and very cool of her. She didn't have to do that. She could have, you know, I thought it was very cool of her to do and take responsibility for that and apologize and shout out Metallica. I also thought it was very cool. She was just there to introduce somebody, but she took the opportunity in that stage and that audience to raise awareness about transgender rights, which, you know, considering everything that's going on in the country right now and in the world, and considering what a platform artists have, it's kind of tame. Grammys were a little tame. There wasn't a whole lot. I mean, sure, there was, you know, some feminism and esoteric sort of spirituality that could certainly be read into Beyonce's performance, and Katy Perry, you know, it's a bit, and that was all awesome. But in terms of like straightforward, hard hitting, I'm going to stand up and say something because I have a microphone in front of me. That award goes to Laverne Cox, and it goes to my favorite part of the night, A Tribe Called Quest, featuring Busta Rhymes, Leaders of the New School. The Native Tongues crew was in full effect. Tribe, of course, riding the wave of this amazing comeback album, honoring the memory of their fallen brother, Fife Dawg, who passed away almost exactly a year ago. I think it was March of last year. Complications from diabetes, which he had been fighting for a long time. And, you know, they performed some of their classic stuff, and then they went right into this new track that they had also done on Saturday Night Live in a performance that was also powerful and strong. But this thing at the Grammys, I mean, from the wall that they constructed and burst through to the woman in hijab to the everyone on stage, guys dressed sort of like the S1Ws from, you know, Public Enemy's security force, fists raised in the air, President Agent Orange. If you watch that again, somebody calls Trump a Cheeto. It was awesome. It reminds you of why art, protest music, hip hop music in particular, is so important and continues to be so relevant. It also made me think about the great, great, great documentary directed by Michael Rapaport, who's an actor you might be familiar with. He has some hardcore punk ties. He's got a PMA tattoo on his finger, which was actually visible in an episode of Prison Break. Fun fact. He introduces an H2O music video. He, of course, played the poor, misguided, gullible Nazi skinhead recruit in John Singleton's Higher Learning, which Busta Rhymes was also in. See what I did there? Anyway, Mike Rapp did this Tribe Called Quest documentary back in 2011, Beats, Rhymes, and Life. It's spectacular. It really examines not only the impact of Tribe and classic albums like, you know, Midnight Marauders. Tribe Called Quest is one of the most important groups ever, let alone hip-hop, but on any level. People's Instinctive Travels, Low End Theory. Come on. If you don't know, you need to go investigate. But anyway, the documentary also really shined a light on the troubled friendship and creative partnership, business relationship between Fife Dawg and Q-Tip, the two guys who founded the group, which of course later included Jarobi White, who then left and is now back, and their DJ, Ali Shaheed Muhammad, one of the most handsome men in hip-hop, also one of the guys responsible for the score to Netflix's Luke Cage, if you saw that. I actually have that score on vinyl, partly because I'm a Tribe fan, and also because it's just awesome. When the Tribe documentary came out in 2011, Q-Tip sort of disavowed it. He didn't like the way he was portrayed in it, so on and so forth. The film played at Sundance. Fife was the only member of Tribe in attendance. I had a chance to sit down with both Michael Rapaport and Fife Dawg in 2011 when they were promoting the documentary. And happily, as Fife told me in the interview, he and Q-Tip had reconciled and were back on good terms when we spoke. So I thought, in honor of Fife Dawg, in honor of the cool statement at the Grammys, to sort of tie up this whole Grammy topic here on this first ever Pop Curse Episode Zero, guest-free, just me, I wanted to cheat a little bit and sort of have a guest by playing a few minutes of my interview with Fife Dawg. This is back in 2011. We're talking about Michael Rapaport's Tribe Called Quest documentary, which I'm sure you can find iTunes, Netflix, somewhere. I probably should have looked that up before I started talking. But y'all know how to use the Google. You've got the interwebs if you're listening to this, surely. Go find that Tribe Called Quest documentary directed by Michael Rappaport. Beats, Rhymes, and Life, The Travels of a Tribe Called Quest is the name of the documentary, by the way. Enjoy a few minutes of the short time that I got to spend with the wonderful, wonderful, awesome legend, Fife Dog of a Tribe Called Quest.
Yo, microphone check, 1, 2, what is this? The 5 foot assassin with the roughneck business. I float like gravity, never had a cavity. Got more rhymes than the one that's got family. No need to sweat Arsenio to gain some type of fame. No shame in my game, cause I always be the same. Styles upon styles upon styles is what I have.
Made Michael Rappaport the perfect guy to help tell this story?
I mean, well, for one, he's a hip-hop fan. He's a fan of hip-hop. He's a New Yorker. You know what I mean? And, well, my reason for thinking so is because he's dealt with movies. He's an actor. But that doesn't always make you a director, so yeah. Forth and so on. But it was his debut. But I just saw the passion in which he wanted to make sure everything was right. He was antsy. He was excited. He was angry at times. But it all led to a positive thing. It came out really, really well. So I was comfortable with him.
Did you get a chance, I think probably at Sundance, to watch this with an audience?
Yes.
And how did that feel? What did you think about the different reactions?
Well, that's when I shed a few tears, because I basically just watched my life flashed in front of my eyes. And I watched it previously with my wife and my moms or whatever, but it wasn't emotional at the time. But to see the things that they were laughing at that I didn't even view as funny, mm-hmm. and then to see how my wife's relationship with myself affected certain people, to see how my relationship with Q-Tip affected people, some of the fans, it was pretty overwhelming. At the end of the day, but I just lost it because they really embraced it with open arms, and I wanted the rest of them to be there to even see that. It's almost like if my wife is having a child, but we have two shows in London or Sweden, mm-hmm. I'm not going to London or Sweden. Mm-hmm. They're going to have to hold me down or something. I'm like, my child is being born. I have to see this. You know what I'm saying? And that's how I felt. When they weren't there, I wanted them to be there so they could witness how these people really accepted this film. Like 300 people.
I think that's the problem, too. They probably watched it on a computer screen if they could see it. You know, I found as a student of all this and interviewing bands, and a lot of the great collaborations and partnerships have some of that tension, you know, whether it's James and Lars and Metallica, whether it's Lennon and McCartney, whether it's Jimmy Page and Robert Plant. I mean, throughout a lot of genres, these guys that that make incredible contributions like Tribe, a lot of times at the core of it, there's this duo where they're best friends and brothers, but there's friction.
Yeah.
Do you think that friction also contributes to the creative side? Was that always kind of part of it?
Absolutely. It does. And sometimes it would get out of hand and things of that nature. And most of the time it would get out of hand because of lack of communication. And I'm at fault for that, you know what I'm saying, just as much as he is, you know what I mean? But at the end of the day, I don't know if John Lennon and Paul McCartney grew up together. I don't know if Keith Richards and Mick Jagger grew up together. All I know is Kamal Fareed and Malik Taylor grew up together. And there's going to come a time where we're going to have to put all of that professional business aside, all the BS that comes along with the business aside, and be Malik and Kamal versus Fife and Q-Tip. You understand what I'm saying? And we've done that recently, and I feel real good about it. And, you know, before anything else, we needed to be friends again, period.
That's good. That's really good to hear.
I think if we decide to do something along the way again, it will be better off because we're boys again.
I think the reason why A Tribe Called Quest is still relevant is because it was truth.
Yo, microphone check, 1, 2, what is this? The 5 foot assassin with the roughneck business. Fife Dog Rest in peace. And that was a little bit of Q-Tip we heard there at the end from the trailer from the 2011 Tribe Called Quest documentary, which, once again, you should watch. A couple of things I want to mention. One is a show called Greater Creators, which I had the pleasure of writing and collaborating with my good friend Comic Book Girl 19. Comic Book Girl 19 is a YouTube personality, a magical person on many levels, super passionate, super knowledgeable, super artistic. She came up with this idea, her and her producing partner, a guy named Tyson, who's also a pal, for the show called Greater Creators that is an examination of filmmakers, artists, comic book people, all sorts of iconic people who have contributed to pop culture in some significant way. People that you've probably heard of, maybe you know a lot about, maybe you don't know much about, maybe you've never heard of. It's a nice deep dive in a really cool, fun, and engaging way into the most important works and the life stories of people like Stephen King, Alan Moore, Jack Kirby, Yodowarski. It was a lot of fun to put together. I got to talk about a lot of things that I love. I got to learn a little more about some things. I got to learn a lot more about some other things. All the thanks to the world of Comic Book Girl 19. We worked together a year or so ago on Marvel Comics Off the Rack series for Verizon Go 90. This show, Greater Creators, is through Machinima. It's also available through Verizon Go 90. The first two episodes are already out, one on Frank Frazetta, one on Jack Kirby, the King of Comics. And there's a bunch more on the way. There's a new one every week. If you go to my website, I have info about how you can watch that, ryanjdowney.com. Which reminds me, popcurse.com, that's popcurse, one word. That's a thing that exists. Popcurse on Twitter, Popcurse on Instagram. You can also find me on Twitter at Ryan Downey, D-O-W-N-E-Y, and on Instagram and Snapchat, Superhero HQ, as in headquarters. This has been Popcurse Episode 0. I want to say, before I go, I am very, very grateful that my friends and brothers in the Dillinger Escape Plan are headed home safe and sound, banged up, shaken up, but very much alive after a crazy, crazy vehicular accident in Poland. The band was on tour in Europe right around the midpoint of a 7-week tour, what was to be a 7-week headlining tour. Their bus had broken down in Poland, was stopped on the side of the road, and was slammed into, rear-ended by a truck. There are broken bones, scrapes, bruises, sprains. The band is not able to finish the tour. They're coming home. This is a band that's been a part of my life since the mid to late 90s, when my old band, Burn It Down, toured with the earliest incarnation of the Dillinger Escape Plan, Ben Wyman being the guy who was in the band then, who's still in the band now, one of my oldest friends. Greg, of course, has become a very close friend of mine in the last few years. I was actually the manager for the Dillinger Escape Plan for a good 2.5-3 years. Liam, Billy, I love all of you guys. I'm glad you're okay. I can't wait to see each one of you. And to play us out here, Popcurse Episode 0. This is the title track from One of Us is the Killer, the record that I got to work with the Dillinger guys a couple years ago. This is a B-side, the Easy Girl remix from our buddy Sean Lopez from the band Far and the group Crosses. Popcurse Episode 0. Bye.